com.
Welcome to Shattering Myths. I am Yada. Each weekday here on GCN, we strive to expose the destructive myths which are associated with religion and politics, patriotism and the media, and with military and economic schemes. Instead of merely presenting the news, our mission is to understand what is actually occurring while predicting how these events will shape our world. Then during our second hour, we will engage God on His terms through evidence and reason, since He alone is the one reliable voice in an exceedingly troubled world. Our phone number, if you'd like to participate at any time over the next 2 hours in this discussion, is 877-300-7645. First, we're going to turn to Europe and to Reuters. Throughout Europe's debt crisis, this article reads, Northern European leaders have said that they will not stand for taxpayers having to fork out money to other countries for their problems. And they were not in favor of, quote, taxpayer-funded bailouts. So what the Reuters article, written at the behest of the European Union, is trying to convey is that rather than bailouts costing the taxpayer money, they're actually making the taxpayer money. Yes, this is the economics of the Reuters journalist, at least when he's conveying the propaganda of central bankers. Now, what happens when a country's debt reaches the point that its debt is no longer serviceable, which means that they have accumulated deficits so large that it becomes way too great a risk for any country or institution or individual to fork over more money to them. I mean, we all know this. You're an individual. You can only borrow so much, and if you don't pay back what you have borrowed, no one will loan you money anymore. You know, if you have borrowed 80% of the value of your home and you've stopped making payments on your existing loan because you don't have the revenue to do it, you're not going to find another bank to say, well, let me give you another 20% valuation. That's what it means when your debt becomes unserviceable. Well, throughout Europe, the debt levels in many nations, including Greece and Italy and Spain and Portugal, Ireland, have reached the level that they are unserviceable. And so the central bankers have decided that the best way to resolve the problem of these countries having so much debt that they can no longer get anyone to loan money to them is for them to loan more money to them. You know, that's like saying that the best way to fight a heroin addiction is to provide a lot more heroin. But what now the European bankers want the world to believe is that these bailouts, which are funded by the taxpayer, really don't cost the taxpayer any money. And to summarize the article, what they're saying is that because of the fact that the donor countries, if you will, the countries providing the loans are financially better off than the countries needing the loans, the difference between the interest rates that the countries borrowing the money to supply the loans to the indebted countries is lower than the interest rates in those countries that are hopelessly in debt. And so if you look at the interest rate differential, that shows how much money the donor countries are saving. And they say, so there's no risk at all. This is just all great. It's the Reuters journalist uses the term mythonomics, speaking of how stimulating economies by providing more loans backed by the citizens of other countries to fix their addiction is really a way to save money as opposed to a way to cost them money. And they use the interest rates differential to show how big the saving is. Now, mind you, if they were not providing the money, they wouldn't have any interest being charged on the on said loans. Also, what happens when the country defaults? You know, you look at Cyprus. The reason the Cyprus banking system failed is because the European Union forced banks, particularly Cypriot banks, to write off debt to Greece. And so they wrote off billions upon billions of dollars of debt to Greece, and having written off those, what they considered to be assets, the loans that they had made, all of a sudden Cyprus was bankrupt because of what the European community had forced their banks to do. And then it confiscated their depositor savings. So here's the best that the Western journalists can do, which is to say that we ought not worry about the deficits because those providing the deficits, the money for the deficits, pay lower interest rates than those borrowing the money, and therefore there actually is a savings, and we ought not worry about anybody failing to pay off their loans because, well, we just ought not worry about that. Turning to before we turn to the next item on the news, the reason that that kind of mentality prevails and the reason that kind of a story will be circulated is because of the financial illiteracy of most of the world. It's probably less than 1 in 100,000 people who actually know what fiat money is about, why central banks exist, how they manipulate economies, how they cause recessions, how they profit from recessions. The consequence of inflation is being the most sinister of all taxes. Those kinds of things and the interaction between central bankers and the interplay between bankers and politicians is something very few people understand. Even the difference between a central banker and a commercial banker. And because of the illiteracy, economic illiteracy, of the vast preponderance of people, their future is being stolen from them. You know, ignorance is not bliss. Yahweh said it's deadly, pertaining to him, but it's also deadly pertaining to everyone, especially relative to what's being done financially. And when you have folks like this saying that bailouts actually save money as opposed to cost money, the myths are propagated. This is another interesting myth. This is the myth that we've just covered is the best way to resolve the problem of a country having more debt than it can service is to provide it with ever more debt. This is the myth of the best way to bring peace to a region that is embroiled in war is to supply more weapons. The Afghan border police, engaged by recent clashes with their Pakistani counterparts, are pleading to the United States for more weapons to take on their neighbors, escalating the tensions between the two sides. So we're supplying billions of dollars of weapons to Pakistan. We're supplying billions of dollars of weapons to Afghanistan. Afghanistan and Pakistan are now fighting each other, and Afghanistan is telling the United States that to resolve this problem, what the United States needs to do is give even more weapons to Afghanistan, which we'll probably do. This is an example of the stupidity of religion and how religion almost universally creates hypocrites, those who claim of their opponents that which they themselves are guilty of. We're going to turn to Israel. Israeli police detained Jerusalem's most senior economic cleric following clashes between Muslim and Jewish worshippers on Tuesday. Sheikh Mohammed Hussein, he is the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. He is a descendant of Mohammed Husani, who is easily the most influential Muslim of the last century. He was also the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. Husani is the fellow that created the rage between Muslims in Israel and the few Jewish settlers who were there, began the terror that was deployed on them. So the first Muslim to aggressively terrorize, to use terror tactics against Jews in Israel, at least in the modern era, was the Grand Mufti, the highest ranking Islamic leader in Jerusalem. And in the case of Muhammad Husani, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem before and during World War II, before that he had served in the Ottoman Turkish army as an officer, and was a witness to, maybe even participated in, the genocide of 1.5 million Armenian Christians at the end of that war by the Turks. He then allied with Adolf Hitler in World War II. And his love for Hitler would be their shared hatred of God's chosen people, Jews. It was Husani, in meetings directly with Hitler, who convinced Hitler that his original plan, which was to rob Jews in Germany and other places in Europe of their property, confiscating it while exiling them, was not the proper plan. And so the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem convinced Adolf Hitler that the better strategy was to, after confiscating the Jewish property, to kill them. You could work them as slaves in a concentration camp, but only under the situation whereby no one would ever walk out of those concentration camps. And so the final solution, while it's attributed to Eichmann and Hitler, was actually the brainchild of the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, the highest ranking Muslim at the time. Well, his follow-on successor was temporarily under arrest in Jerusalem, and it was in connection with a disturbance outside the old city's Al-Aqsa Mosque. The Al-Aqsa Mosque was built on the Temple Mount by Muslims to show that they had conquered the Jews, that they had now stolen the land that belonged to the Jews, and they built their shrine on top of Yahweh's temple. To Shattering Myths. You can participate in our discussion by calling 877-300-7645. We are talking about the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem and a mini riot that took place on the Temple Mount. It is the Temple Mount because it is where the first and second temple, the house, the home of Yahweh in his chosen city, in his chosen land, in a land that represents his home. That's where it was placed. So when Muslims, which is based, the Islamic religion is based entirely on replacing the one and only God, Yahweh, with a characterization of Satan. Allah is modeled after Satan. He spends all of his time in hell, tormenting non-Muslims, those who don't surrender, don't submit to him. Every aspect of Islam represents the antithesis of Yahweh's instructions to us. He is the adversary of Yahweh and his chosen people. The Islamic religion has Jews as their primary enemy. And so when the Muslims stormed out of Arabia following Muhammad's death, after overhunting Jews in Arabia, they conquered much of the world, including what was a Byzantine province at the time in Judea. And the first thing that they did is they built a shrine to the devil right there there on the top of the Temple Mount, and not one, but two. The Dome of the Rock, which is what I call the Dome of the Hoofy Print, where Muhammad, on his imagined journey on the wild ass, during his sleep one night, rode his winged ass to Jerusalem from Mecca. This was in the immediate wake of the satanic verses. And then from, while in Jerusalem on the Temple Mount, he claims that the temple was still there and that he met with all sorts of dead individuals, including Moses and the... And then he jumped up using wild ass to heaven by way of hell. The first stop on the way up to heaven was hell, where he claims he saw that the inhabitants were mostly women. They were hanging by their breasts, and they were being tortured by Allah because they did not properly submit to their husbands. This story, then, which is mentioned in the Quran, is the reason that Muslims built a dome of the rock over the hoofy print where Muhammad's wild and winged ass took him up to heaven and through hell. So that's the what's there. The real reason for all of it, of course, is Satan motivating his religious zealots to thumb their nose at Yahweh by building their shrines on top of the Temple Mount. Well, it is an interesting situation because during the two wars, the Six-Day War and the Yom Kippur War, the Muslims who had tried to wipe the Jews out the last lost both wars. They also lost the War of Independence for Israel. So they had lost three wars in a row, even when they outnumbered the Jews more than 100-1. And yet Moshe Dayan, an atheist general, decided at the time after conquering the Muslims and subduing them, decided that he would give the Temple Mount to the Muslims. Now, here is Jerusalem's the most set apart, most important site in the city. And rather than saying, you know, now that we have control of it, let's cleanse it of the religious shrines of those who are motivated, who are indoctrinated to hate and kill us. You know, that would have been the rational thing to do. They built these to thumb their nose at us. Let's just take them down to say we're all square. That would have been the most rational thing to do. The next most rational thing to do would have been to say, all right, you've got these monstrosities here desecrating our most important site. We'll let you keep them, but this becomes an international site. Everybody gets access. Or the third thing he could have done, which would have been the worst thing, is to say, no Jew can go there. You Muslims, this is your spot now. It used to be ours, but it's now yours. You can exclude everyone else from being there. And unfortunately, that is precisely what has happened. And now any time a Jew goes to the place that has been set apart amongst every place in the world, they are harassed by the Muslims. So here's how the story continues. The compound is where the mosque lies. It's revered by Muslims and Jews and is a frequent flashpoint for violence. It is known by Muslims as Haram al-Sharif, or the Noble Sanctuary, and to Jews as the Temple Mount. It is the Temple Mount. That is what it is. It's just like calling Israel Palestine. It is Israel. It was renamed by folks that were trying to cover up the rightful name as Palestine. The same thing is true with the Noble Sanctuary. Welcome back to Shattering Mist. I'm your host, Yetta. We're covering a story in Jerusalem. Names are always important aspects of everything. when a place has been known as the Temple Mount since the time of Dode in 1000 BCE, and then it changes to the Noble Sanctuary because of a mythical journey by a liar known as Muhammad, where he claimed that he flew on a wild ass to Jerusalem following the satanic verses to meet with the Hebrew prophets in a non-existent temple, obviously lying. And as a result of that religious lie, the place is renamed to the Noble Sanctuary. You know that malfeasance is underfoot. It's just like the changing the name of Israel to Palestine. Malfeasance is underfoot. During Tuesday's clashes, this article reads, Muslim worshippers are reported to have thrown chairs at Jewish visitors to the compound. That's typical of Muslims. Let's show how tolerant and accepting we are. Let's show how lovely our religion is. When Jews come to the most important place in the world to them, since we've conquered them in the past, and this is the last vestige of us conquering them, let's show our gratitude to Moshe Dayan for letting us even have these shrines here by throwing rocks and chairs at them. The Jews can go to the compound but are not allowed to pray or perform religious ceremonies. So you're not allowed. This is the temple to Yahweh, where it was, and you're not allowed to do anything religious. You're not allowed to pray. But, of course, Muslims can and do. Those who are seen to break the rules can be expelled by the police. The Mufti was investigated for 6 hours over what happened on the Temple Mount and over his recent declarations about the situation there. In other words, Muslims want to inspire other Muslims to act badly because they want there to be an open state of rage against Jews. Tuesday's violence coincided with Israel's celebration of Jerusalem Day, which marks the anniversary of its capture of East Jerusalem in 1967 in the Middle East War. That was the war that called the Six-Day War, where Israel beat the combined Muslim assault against it and would have ended up not only with the Sinai and with Syria and with Jordan, but would have been unstoppable throughout the entire Middle East. It had the United States not reined Israel in, they would have controlled most of the Muslim world. Anyway, Israel annexed East Jerusalem after the war, a move not recognized by the international community. So under that standard, the United States next week will be giving up the states of Texas, Arizona, New Mexico. They will be giving up most of the western half of the United States because prevailed the same way, except the United States claim isn't nearly as good for the southwestern states because we initiated the war, and in the case of Israel, it was responding to the threat of the Muslims. The Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas called for Sheikh Hussein's immediate release, calling his arrest a flagrant challenge to the freedom of worship. Now, that was the reason I wanted to share this article with you. The head of the so-called Palestinian Authority, Mohammed Mahmoud Abbas, who, by the way, was not elected to that position, he lost the election by a two-thirds vote, he's referring to this arrest, for which the man was freed moments thereafter, as a flagrant challenge to freedom of worship. And yet, what were the Muslims protesting? Why did this become a problem? Because the Jews wanted to worship on the most important site in the world to them, and the Muslims reacted angrily and refused as a flagrant challenge to their freedom to do so. And yet, when the Israel government questions the person who inflamed the Muslim passions against the Jews, rather than the Muslims being opposed to freedom of worship, according to the idiot that is the head of the Palestinian Authority. No, no, no. It was the Jews who were opposed to freedom of worship, not us. Never mind the rocks and the chairs that we were throwing. Never mind our attitude. Never mind that we don't want any Jew on their own Temple Mount. It's those guys who are bad, not us. The Jordanian parliament voted for a non-binding resolution demanding the expulsion of Israel's ambassador in response to the arrest. That's how screwed up the Islamic world is. Speaking of the screwed up nature of Muslims, Reuters is reporting that three suicide bombers struck at a Kurdish security force and the local headquarters of the Kurdish political party in a disputed area of Iraq on Wednesday, killing three people. The Kurds recently decided that, you know, we're getting nowhere in our armed assault against the Turks, who have treated us like we were animals for the last 100 years or so. And since the Turks are going to pretend like they're the sponsor of the cause celeb of a mythical people called the Palestinians, but yet repress the rights of a legitimate people, the Kurds, perhaps maybe the thing we ought to do is, since the American invasion of Iraq, though it was not intended to do, enabled the Kurds to gather in the north of Iraq, put together their own defense, and to exclude themselves, to separate themselves from the Shia and Sunni Muslims that were warring in the rest of the country. And so when the Kurds said, you know, we'll just all hunker down in northern Iraq, we at least have a place to call our own, even though the rest of the world won't recognize it, and it's considered to be a disputed part of Iraq. The United States, of course, was of this notion that you could get the Kurds, the Sunnis, and the Shias all to embrace one another and sing Kumbaya and pretend like they were all one country, as opposed to doing the intelligent thing. If you're going to invade the country, dividing it up between the groups, give them all their own little fiefdoms, and that way they're not killing each other, but we're not that smart. So the Kurds hunker down in their area, and what's the first thing that happens? A suicide bomber is sent out against them. The issue, of course, is money. The oil that comes from the north has to be shipped in pipelines that go through the rest of the country, and these religious zealots can't work out a plan to share the benefits of that oil in a fair and equitable way. It's also interesting that now that America has invaded Afghanistan once by proxy and once by its own troops. By proxy, we invaded Afghanistan by deploying the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, funding them, arming them to attack the Russians. And then once the Russians were ousted and the Taliban formed its government there, in league with Al-Qaeda, whom we had sponsored the first time, we decided we would go to war against our former proxy, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And now the Russians are saying, you know, you really made a mess of this place, and I think we need to strengthen our defenses in that area because of the mess that you've made of this place and the fact that you've armed these people to the teeth. So President Vladimir Putin said Russia must strengthen its defenses in the south and work with Central Asian allies to protect itself against the threat of extremist violence that is emerging from Afghanistan. Putin told a meeting of security his Security Council that the U.S. and NATO forces have not achieved a breakthrough in the fight against terrorist and radical groups in Afghanistan, and that these groups have become more active. In other words, our invasion of Afghanistan has been counterproductive, just as our invasion was of Vietnam. It was counterproductive. Rather than achieving the goal of eliminating a supposed enemy, we manufactured more of the enemy. We empowered and enriched the enemy. The exact same thing has happened that happened in Vietnam, now in Afghanistan. It also happened in Iraq. So Putin says we need to strengthen the security system in that strategic southern area, including its military component. And so what's happening is the Soviets are saying, you made such a mess of things. Maybe we need to reemphasize our control of the area. And guess who the Russians are going to as an ally and partner in all of this? Well, of course, China. And why is China involved? Because the northeastern borders of Afghanistan border on China. They're extraordinarily rich with rare earth minerals, and China is in league with the Taliban now to exploit that mineral wealth. Russia, which supported the UN-led invasion, of course they did. They said, all right, you brought hell on us when you empowered the Taliban and Al-Qaeda to fight the Russian-backed government there. You brought hell on us. Have a little slice of it yourself. Of course, they probably were applauding. The Russians thought that was the best thing that could ever happen to them, is to have the United States squander its prestige, its blood, and its coin in Afghanistan. They were cheerleaders. So they supported the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan in 2001, but have expressed concern that threats to its security will increase following the planned withdrawal of U.S. combat troops by 2014. There is every reason to believe that in the near future we will face a worsening situation, Putin said. You know, Putin's a very evil man, but occasionally even evil men tell the truth. The situation in Afghanistan is deteriorating rapidly, and it's going to continue to get worse. Once we leave Afghanistan, it will be worse than had we not been there. It's just like when we left Vietnam. We made it worse. We sacrificed blood and coin making Vietnam worse. We sacrificed blood and coin making Afghanistan and Iraq worse. News came out of southern Turkey that the Syrian intelligence community had allegedly carried out car bombings that killed 46 people in a Turkish border town. And the likelihood of that being sponsored by the Syrian government is slim to none. But Turkey has never been a reservoir of goodness and truth. And so it is highly likely that Turkey is going to use this to flex their muscle, because Muslims are arrogant and the Turks are especially arrogant. It did kill 46 people, but the high likelihood is that those bombings were perpetrated by the rebels. We'll return to that story in a moment. Thanks for returning to Shattering Myths. We're talking about Turkey. There was a series of car bombings that killed 46 people in a Turkish border town, and Turkey, of course, blamed it on the government of President Bashar al-Assad. It is extraordinarily unlikely that that is what actually occurred. There would be no incentive of any kind for Bashar al-Assad to stop using conventional weapons and to start using car bombs. That's what the rebels use. And also, there would be no reason for Bashar al-Assad to say, you know, I think we can really increase the likelihood that we will prevail against these militias if we go attack the most militarized country in the region. Let's go do some bombings of Turkey, and that will really set us up so that we're certain that we will remain in power. I mean, it's moronic. What happened, of course, is that the rebels detonated those car bombs to create the illusion that the Syrian government had done it because they're looking for Turkey to engage in the war. Happens all the time in the Islamic world. It's just like the Muslim rebels use the sarin gas to create the illusion that the Syrian government had done so to encourage the world to support them more aggressively. But how did Turkey respond? same way that Turkey always responds. It's time for the international community to come together and act against this regime, Prime Minister Tayyip Erdogan said in a speech broadcast on Turkish television. We will not lose our calm heads. We will not depart from common sense, and we will not fall into the trap that they are trying to push us into. But whoever targets Turkey will sooner or later pay the price. So what is he saying? That he's going to now invade Turkey? No, he's not going to do that. What is he going to do? Start flying missions into Turkey so that his training missions can be with live ammunition and with live targets? No, he may do that. But we really have a mess in this part of the world. And the last thing the world needs is for the surrounding countries to become even more involved. Because the reality is it's already a proxy war, having very little to do with Syria and having almost everything to do with Saudi Arabia and Qatar on one side, trying to assert the influence of Sunni Islam, and Iran on the other, trying to maintain the influence it gained as a result of the United States invasion of Iraq. Along with this, showing the corrupt nature of the rebels, a video is now appearing that shows a Syrian rebel taking the bite out of the heart of a dead soldier. So here's a Syrian rebel. He killed a Syrian army soldier. And he decided to celebrate the death of the Syrian soldier by cutting out his heart and eating it. The U.S.-based Human Rights Watch identified the rebel as Abu Sakr, a well-known insurgent from the city of Homs. The main Syrian opposition coalition said that he will be put on trial. Yeah, right. The video, which cannot be independently authenticated, seems to show him not only cutting out the heart, but eating it. He says, I swear to Allah, I will eat your hearts and your livers, you soldiers of Bashar, the dog. The man says, referring to President Bashar al-Assad as he stands over the soldier's corpse. There are many examples of militias and soldiers the world over acting badly. If you look at the way that the Japanese acted in World War II or the German SS troops, they were savages. Now, they were savages because the regime that they were represented was both religious and political. There was no separation in Imperial Japan between the religion of Japan and the politics of Japan. Just as with Hitler's Mein Kampf, which was part of the people's religion, there was no separation between the religion of Nazi Germany and the politics of Nazi Germany. Well, the same thing is true with these Islamic rebels. There is no separation between their religion and politics. And when those things coalesce and become one, this kind of savagery is manifest. So the article concludes, the mutilation of bodies of enemies is a war crime, but it's even more serious issue is the very rapid descent into sectarian rhetoric and violence. So here is a political statement, a military statement that this man made, and it's called a sectarian or religious statement, because, of course, that war is a war between Sunni and Shia Muslims, both fighting, by the way, with the blessing of the same wannabe God. We'll return to Shattering Myths in a moment.
Hi, this is Dr. Joel Wallach, the Dead Doctors Don't Lie guy. I want to personally invite you to a wonderful 2-hour free seminar.